Hey, it's episode 415 of the 343 podcast. Today is all about the infamous first touch. Yes, what makes for a good first touch? What is so essential about having a first touch? Everybody seems to think that they believe or understand what that means, but I want to rewind you back to 2010. So Jürgen Klinsmann was a broadcast analyst during the 2010 World Cup, I believe it was. And after the United States got bounced, and lost, I forget what the match was. Maybe it was against Ghana. They asked him, hey, what's missing in the U.S. player? And Jürgen went on air and said, it's all about the first touch. Fast forward 15 years. Do we understand first touch here in the United States? I think we're a little bit better, but we're not there. And we have a long way to go. So today's conversation is all about that. And I hope you enjoy it. Here we go. Speaking of first touch, look, it's no mystery how it gets developed. It gets developed in all different contexts, whether it's playing by yourself, playing against the wall, playing with friends, playing in pickup games. But coaches who are actually coaching teams, you have a large role to play as well. And for that, you can go to 343coaching.com to learn how to incorporate, how to refine a player's first touch, how to chisel it, how to focus it properly. Yes, it has a lot to do with rondos and much more. So 343coaching.com is where you want to go. I would recommend signing up for the premium program right away. But if you don't know of 343, you don't know what we've accomplished, the pioneering work that has been achieved here, maybe get to know us a little bit longer. And so there's a free program for you to get your feet wet first before hopping into the premium program itself. And parents, you have a huge role to play when it comes to first touch, because the reality of the situation is most of the players develop their first touch outside of the team training environment, as it should be and as it must be done. Doing just team training twice a week or three times a week is not going to cut it, guys. So what do you do? What is your son or daughter supposed to do outside of that situation? Well, they should be working on their own one way or another. And at 343masterclass.com, we help you with that. We show you exactly what your player should be doing, what kind of exercises they should be doing. So head on over. 343masterclass.com is where parents should be going to better guide and mentor their kids. Last but certainly not least, if you happen to be coaching in the 7v7 environment, you're covered too. You go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, here we go. Enjoy this one.
All right, like I said, let's get back to some coaching development, player development. We haven't talked about any of this type of stuff in a while. It's going through the masterclass, Gary. And the first topic that really stuck out to me is because, and I'm seeing this so much, is the importance of first touch. And I don't think we've ever done an episode on first touch, why it matters, what is a good first touch. Gary, if you go to any high school game, even any college game, bro, like you're going to see on the field shocking first touches all over the place. And I think if you don't have the trained football eye, you might be deceived in thinking a player has a good first touch. And it's not until you watch the highest levels of football to where you see like, wow, there's actually a massive difference in what an MLS player is doing or a player in La Liga is doing. Okay, so first of all, for you, Gary, how do you define and how can you identify, you know, what is a great first touch? What is somebody that has really mastered being able to control the ball on a dime, perfect first touch to set themselves up? How do you recognize that yourself as a practitioner?
Well, how I recognize it's going to be very different than what I'm going to say. So what I'm going to say, everybody understands. What is a good first touch? Do you actually control the ball when it comes to you under all scenarios? Meaning, are you able to have the ball do exactly what you want it to do? And that usually means, right, have it like kill the ball right in front of you. Okay, not underneath you, not have it bounce off your foot or off your shin and go, you know, 3 feet away from you or 3 yards away from you. No, you kill it and it goes exactly where you want it to go. Everybody understands that, Benny. This is not a mystery. I'm not saying anything new. And so that's why I'm saying, how do I identify a good first touch? Well, that's hard to wrap your head around because you can't describe verbally or even visually at times the biomechanics associated with a good first touch. You can have people do what I just described a moment ago, and the biomechanics are all wrong. It's not fluid. It's not natural. My best description that I've ever come up with since I was a, I don't know, teenager 20 years ago, whatever it is you shouldn't look like a robot, okay, when you're doing it. It shouldn't look forced. It shouldn't look like you're so concentrated, right, to make that happen. It should look completely effortless. It should look like a completely natural thing. You know, when a bird jumps off a cliff and starts gliding through the air, it's completely natural, right? But if you throw a chicken off of the cliff, the chicken has wings, but it's going to look like a disaster, you know, trying to flap its wings and trying to stay in the air. So that's kind of like what it looks like when you don't have a good first touch. Even if the ball is being controlled well, you look like a chicken, you know, trying to fly. And that's hard to identify. I think you have to have watched and experienced so much goddamn football, Benny, to then be able to qualitatively do the eye test, as they call it here, to say, oh, wow, Jordi Alba has a phenomenal first touch. And Anthony Robinson, the Jedi, has a shockingly bad first touch. Because, and I mentioned Anthony Robinson because to this day, Americans in particular here still think that Anthony Robinson is some sort of super elite world-class outside back. And okay, he's a good outside back. But when I say something like he's terrible from a technical perspective, terrible first touch, they think I'm crazy. Like, oh my God, what are you talking about? He has an elite first touch. He wouldn't be playing in the Premier League if his first touch wasn't on point. It's shit, okay? If you compare it to Jordi Alba, if you compare it to Dani Alves, if you compare it to Marcelo, if you compare it to those sorts of players, Anthony Robinson looks like a chicken who jumped off a cliff and is trying to fly. So I don't know what else to say about it, Benny, but it can't be quantified, I guess, is my bottom line.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to tell. I mean, it would seem like obvious. It's like, oh, okay, that player, the center mid just got the ball and he took a nice touch right in front of it, stopped dead. But to your point about the biomechanics of it, it's like some players just look so stiff on the ball, or the ball, you know, pops away 2 or 3 yards away. Whereas an elite world-class player, it's like the ball, their cleat almost has glue on it, bro, to where they get pinged in a ball at 40 miles an hour and it just stops dead right there. There's so many ways that we can take this, Gary, but let's start with, why do you think
other countries... Well, let me continue.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, let me continue really quick, because I've heard it over the years now with youth soccer parents who kind of know that MLS is crap and American soccer is crap, right? And the U.S. men's national team historically is crap. And they'll say things like... And this is coming from a place that where they're disgruntled, right? They'll say things like, my son's U14 team and my son's first touch is better than Breck Shea's first touch, you know, because they see like Breck Shea or an MLS player and they have a shocking first touch, right? And then they go to their son's game, their 13-year-old, and they see their own son bring a ball out of the air and kills it. It's right there, totally under control, or receives a bullet pass and kills it. Great first touch. And they actually think that their son has a better first touch than Breck Shea or DeAndre Yedlin or Mix Discarude or Dax McCarty. You know what I'm saying? And this is how confusing the objective thing is, because it's not true at all. Your son probably has a terrible first touch, okay? He just happens to be doing okay and decent because you're under zero pressure. The ball is not coming rifled in like it comes rifled in at the professional level. The pressure that you have on you mentally also is completely different than it is at the professional level. So you're completely confused as to the degree of a quality first touch. Breck, I guarantee you, Breck Shea's first touch is better than your 14-year-old kid. You got me? And so you get exposed with the levels to this thing, because then when Breck Shea goes to Stoke City, oh, now you get exposed. And here, I'm going to shit on the Premier League a little bit. You actually don't get that exposed in the Premier League. because people are going to take the issue. I don't care. Sorry, English fans. The Premier League is not as technical as, say, La Liga or Serie A, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot more space in the Premier League, in the sense that it's so back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Usually it's not as compact as in the other places, and the spaces aren't as reduced as the other spaces. So there's a lot more margin for error, I believe. I'm thoroughly convinced of this, with having a top, top, top level first touch in the Premier League. Anyway, why am I saying that? Because I brought up Breccia and Stoke City, but if Breccia were to have gone to La Liga, it would have been exposure to the maximum, even worse.
Yeah, Gary, to add another player to the list, I'm sure you've seen this video of Erling Haaland before a game with Man City. They're doing a rondo.
He's terrible.
But people are like, oh my God, like, what the fuck? Like, I have a better first touch than Haaland. Like, no, you fucking don't. No, you don't.
Yeah.
Like, no, okay, even if this fool has like a brick for a foot and his first touch right there in the rondo, like, this fool is still like, if a ball gets smashed into him at 80 miles an hour to his foot, back to goal, defender right behind him, he'll bring it down clean. You know, your 12-year-old son's not gonna have the same touch as Haaland, I guarantee you, bro. But right there, it did look pretty bad.
Yeah.
Anyway,
player profiles, Benny, right? Because the center striker, I mean, you want him to have a phenomenal first touch, but what is your specialty? Your specialty isn't in control under high pressure situations where you have to have scanned the whole freaking 360 degrees and be able to dish things off in one touch or do beautiful turns or get out of pressure situations. No, you don't have the requirements of a first touch that a central midfielder has. You don't have to be, a Vitinha level first touch to play striker. You just have to bang the fucking things in and you're solid.
Yeah, true. Yeah, it's fucking funny. But okay, Gary, so where I was going to go with it is, why do you think, and I'm guessing that I already know the answer, but I want to hear, why do you think players like in Spain or Brazil, Germany, they're so much more technically proficient? And you talked about the fluidity of the movement and the biomechanics. Why does it look so much more natural for them versus the American player?
It's a great question. I'm going to do some educated speculation here. And if folks think this is crazy, but you know, you can talk to, I don't know, people may, if you've been sticking around for a while, there's a longtime friend, colleague by the name of Kefren Fuller, who used to coach here in the United States in the DC area, then moved to Holland. And he shares this opinion with me, and the South Americans share this opinion with me. And there's something to do with, I mean, you always see the Brazilians dancing, right? Or the Argentinians many times dancing. And that requires coordination. It requires smoothness. It requires great control of your body, right? In many degrees of freedom and dimensions. And you have to be fluid when you dance. When you see somebody who doesn't know how to dance, what does it look like? It looks like a freaking chicken, okay, clucking around. It looks like a robot clucking around. So there's some cultural component to it all, Benny, where if you have that in your DNA, metaphorically speaking, then when you play with the ball just becomes a prop to your dancing. You're dancing with the ball. And if you're maybe, I don't know, the traditional English or the traditional German prototypical player or the traditional American prototypical player, they're not smooth like that. They don't know how to dance with the ball, Benny, because they don't have that sort of control with their body, that fluidity with their body. So again, educated speculation. This is just a correlation, a pattern recognition that always seems to be there, Ben. The guys who know how to dance know how to flow with the ball. It's really weird. I'm sure it doesn't hold 100% of the time, but I'll tell you this much. I'm not the first one to think about that. This has been something that has been thought of and believed to be true for generations.
You heard it from Gary. If you want a good first touch, enroll your kid in a salsa class for
Christmas.
That's funny. No, but even like you said Germany, right? But there's still some really good, technically proficient masterclass midfielders, amazing first touch. And I'm sure they didn't dance growing up, Gary, you know? Well, it just feels like the American player is so far behind and so lacking in this technical component of having a good first touch. And sure, like, okay, does Tyler Adams have a good first touch? Or I was going to say Weston McKennie, but I know you'll laugh at that one. Like, to the average art or to the common commentator, it's like, yeah, they get a ball pinged to them 50 yards in the air across the field. I'm sure they're going to bring it down cleanly. But again, it's, I don't know, it's hard to describe. It's nowhere near the level of what you see elsewhere around the world. They just seem so far behind.
Yeah. It's interesting to think of from the perspective of the personal training culture that exists in the United States and the suburban demographic that we're always pointing to as being the mainstream demographic in the pay-to-play ecosystem. When you see like personal trainers or these videos online and trying to teach you how to receive a ball or strike a ball, and they're showing you the mechanics of it all. Have your plant foot right here, right? At this angle to the ball, and then do this sort of stroke, you know, and whip your body around like this. You know what I'm talking about? Or, hey, lock your ankle and do this, you know, and pivot it another 10 degrees. All the objective mechanics of it. It's no wonder that what comes out of that development pipeline is shocking technically. Terrible, terrible. Because that's not what's happening in Argentina and Brazil. Nobody's sitting there and then going down on a knee and showing the kid, okay, pivot your foot like this and lock your ankle like that. And when you approach the ball, approach it like this and put your plant foot right here instead of right here. They aren't doing that stuff in Brazil and Argentina and Colombia and Venezuela and Uruguay. And the elite players didn't go through that. That's no way to teach technique. But here, there's a market for that sort of stuff. Come to this personal trainer or this personal training, and we're going to show you. And that's how they show you. The best, honestly, the best personal training, Benny, if we can even call it personal training, is like, look, drop your kid off here. He's going to play. I got other kids here, you know, and I'm going to be here. And we're all just going to play. That's probably the best personal training. Instead of drop your kid off over here, it's a one-on-one session. I'm going to film this and I'm going to tell him how to lock his ankle, and you're developing a robot.
Yeah, true. No, to that point, Gary, you see it so many times on the videos of personal trainers here. It's like five poles set up, a cone over here. I'm going to check into this window. Ball gets pinged into me, first touch, play back, side shuffle, get into the other window. And you see the video, and like, this kid's been going to the personal trainer for like 3 years, and the ball gets played into his foot, you know, not even a hard pass, Gary, and the ball's still bouncing up. And it's like, bro, how much money? And I don't want to call this a waste of money. Maybe it's not to some people, maybe they get value out of it, but how much money has been spent on useless, meaningless personal training? And that's not to say that every personal trainer out there is bad intention. And no, I know there are some good ones out there, but the most common traps that I see parents get into, I see this video of doing these little hurdles and slide in tier and take a, I'm like, bro, you would get so much more benefit if you just go to the wall and spend 2 hours there. You'll get way more out of that session than you would dribbling through cones or doing quick feed. And go to the wall, dude. It's insane.
There's levels to all this, because I could see there being a benefit for players to kind of, you know, on a schedule, show up at this place at this time, and being with the personal trainer, you're going to get touches. And are they going to improve? Yes, they're going to improve. Are they going to get better? They're going to get better as a player. They are going to improve, Benny. Just like if you just spend time juggling the ball, even though you don't juggle the ball in the actual game, just juggling the ball makes you better. You'll get better with a personal trainer. But in the context of what we've been discussing of what is a good first touch and what distinguishes a good first touch, what makes Jordi Alba different than Anthony Robinson, in that context, then yeah, it ain't going to work. That stuff comes from somewhere else.
Yeah. And I think, Gary, there is a place for functional one-on-one training, meaning like, let's say you're an outside back and okay, you're going to work on defending the winger and denying the cross. Or okay, you're a center back. Let's work on pumping balls in behind, you dropping off, getting a good header clearance. I just feel like a lot of money is wasted in the technical part of the training where it's like touches here, touches there, dribble, dribble. Like I just don't see the value of it, I guess you could say. Is there value? Sure, but I think that you can spend your time better in different environments and whatnot.
Yeah. The challenge is just like a team coaches and team training is the culture here, and you have a customer and the customer has to think that they're getting value. And so you have to put on this whole dog and pony show of like, oh, look, I'm actually instructing your kid of how to do this and how to do that and having them go through cones and flags and that stuff. And then that perception makes the parent feel like this is okay. This is like legit versus bring your kid over. We're just going to fuck around, you know, for an hour or two. They don't see the value in that at all. They'll be like, what is this? Is this some kind of joke or something? You're just stealing my money. So they don't get it then. That's why I think a lot of the incentives in the system, in the personal training space, forces people to do that whole shit, Ben. Maybe even go high tech with little lights and beeps and whistles and stopwatches and all that shit.
Yeah. No, to the average eye, if you show up to the field and there's all different types of stuff, like a mannequin, poles, cones, you're like, wow, this looks awesome. Like when I see somebody like getting personal trained in basketball and I see them have like, you know, cones set up and like, I know nothing about basketball, but I'm thinking like, wow, this looks like a phenomenal session, right? Versus if it was just the coach and the kid and nothing else. But so I think there's this whole concept of like, oh, you need all this extra gear and you need agility poles and you need mannequins. Otherwise you're not going to get the bang for your buck, I guess. But Gary, let's talk about at what point is it too late in a player's career to fix their first touch? Okay. And maybe you can also get into, if you don't mind, I know Brian was notorious for assigning homework to all the players, you know, week after week, he would give them different assignments. If a player were to come to Brian, or Brian were to recognize and say, hey, your first touch, not where it needs to be, you know, what would he be telling them to do? So there's two questions in there. At what age is it too late? And then player comes to you, how do they fix their first touch?
So the too late question is a good one, and it depends on what we define as too late. For years, I've always said, because, you know, here in the United States, they hype up youth players a lot. If a player makes it to the youth national team, there's a very high probability that pretty soon they're going to be hyped up by these independent accounts on X, you know, or even the media itself saying, oh, this kid is amazing. The future is bright. His ceiling is so high. And I've been notorious for looking at these players as well, because I've always been in the space. And if I'm looking at the kid and the kid is, I don't know, 16 years old and he's on the U17 national team, and I see he has the touch of a Breck Shea or something like that, Josh Sargent. I'm sure in my ex feed, I had something about Josh Sargent saying, or even Weston McKinney, like, no, it's over. This guy doesn't have, you know, the potential for a world-class first touch or world-class technique. It's done. I would get bombarded with comments saying, Gary, how can you say that? He's only 16 years old. Or Gary, how can you say, even worse, Benny, how can you say that? He's only 22. He's so young. No, this would always happen. He's only 22, Gary. He's so young. You know, he's still got 5-6 years until his prime, or 7 years until his prime. No, it's over. It's game over. The biomechanics have been crystallized and calcified into the player. This is how the player, over the course of 10 years, 14 years, 15 years, has always received a ball when it's coming from the left side, or has always received the ball when it's coming through the air, has always received the ball and the neurons are wired a certain way already. The biomechanics are set. to completely change, to have Anthony Robinson all of a sudden have the biomechanics of a Jordi Alba or Marcelo, it's impossible. It ain't happening. It's over. So going back to your question at what age, it depends on what the objective is. If the objective is elite, top level, world class, ooh, mama, that's, I think, like early, Benny, like 15, like things have to be right by 15, I would say. Otherwise, it's probably over already.
I thought you were going to say like 10 or 11, dude.
I'm trying to give people hope, Benny. I don't know what to tell you. People just haven't watched enough, Ben, football, been in the game too long, or actually worked in the game for so long. It was crystal clear to us, to give our audience names that they might be familiar with, especially if they've been following us for a while. At age 10, it was obvious that Efrain Alvarez, okay, who now plays for Chivas, he's the number 10 at Chivas Guadalajara, who was on our team from age 10 to age 18, okay? It was clear from age 10 that he had the elite caliber technical quality. The elite. And all of our other players, or a whole bunch of our other players, had top technical quality in the country. And many of them became professionals also. But it was already at age 10, 11, 12, you already knew who had something totally different level, totally different. And whoever was in second place, also extremely high up there. And then third place and fourth and fifth place, nah. Like they're phenomenal players and they're going to go very far and very high probability that they'll be professionals. But nah, it ain't going to happen. And so yes, 10, 11, 12, you can already kind of tell. But I'm going to say, 14, 15 years old, you're for sure locked in. Your ceiling is locked in from a technical perspective.
Yeah.
For world class, Benny.
Okay. So my question to you is, you just said Efra came in at 10. He already had all the tools to become a world-class player, and he's 10 years old, and there's other players. But how did they get to that point by 10 years old? Is it because they played every single day of their life since the moment that they could walk? Were they on the wall? Did they play futsal? How do you get to that point, and you're only 10 years old?
All of the above plus culture. And what I mean by culture is that it's in your family already. So your parents, your brothers, everybody, your uncles, everybody in your circle have always been about football, had always had football on the TV. They lived and breathed it. So why does that matter? That matters because since the moment the kid opens his eyes, there's football on the TV. And they start developing patterns in their minds already. They're watching America, Chivas, Cruz Azul, Querétaro, San Luis, whatever. If we're talking about Mexico, because Efra is Mexican. Okay, most of our players were Mexican Americans. That's been on the tube, and the kid is just studying that stuff. It's burning patterns of play. It's burning the biomechanics. They see on TV how the top players are receiving balls and passing balls and striking balls. And so naturally you're like, okay, that's how I need to move. That's how I receive a ball properly when the point of attack is being switched and you're receiving a 40-yard diagonal ball. This is how I do it, right? So, and then you start doing it already from age 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So you've got 5 years before they even got to us. So when they get to us, and yes, futsal and on the wall and juggling and being bullied by your big brothers who were also great players, all of those ingredients mixed into the pot then.
Yeah.
So huge advantage, dude. We've talked about the huge advantage of having a father, right, or parents who have been professional players too. So it's not all nepotism, the reason why those players get to become professionals also. That is a factor. Don't get me wrong. You get a lot more opportunities, benefit of the doubt because of the name on your back. But you had to at least gotten to a threshold level of skill for a club to make you a pro also, or give you opportunities also. You can't be shockingly poor, but if you have a dad who was a pro, guess what? The massive advantage, Ben. Answer your question. That's how they got there, man.
Efren's dad was never a pro, was he? Mexico?
No, but you just can't validate this stuff for people who are old. You know what I mean? But it was all, the story is that he was like close, right? He was like right there.
Okay. Yeah. That's all you need to say. He was right there. There's no stats or anything to back it up, but you just got to take him for his word. That guy's a legend, dude. I love that guy.
He is funny.
Yeah. So Gary, I mean, there's different levels to what a first touch can do and what it can unlock for a player. It's one thing to have a good first touch, but it's another thing to have a first touch that does damage to the opponent, meaning adding in extra elements before you receive the ball. So whether it's body feint to the left and your first touch goes across your body to get out of a dangerous situation, there's literally so many different types of first touches that can do damage to your opponent. But how do you train this, Gary? How do you get to the point where you're a center mid, you know there's a guy coming, so you touch it with the inside of your foot behind your leg and you get out of danger that way? How can you train that as a player?
Again, a lot of it has to do with your mirror neurons and being mimetic. And that means having watched football, having watched the pros do it, and then you go into your backyard and you try to emulate what you've seen on TV. Or you go to the racquetball courts, or you go to a wall and you try to emulate that. Or maybe you have a coach, and your coach could be your dad, or it could be your older brother, or it could be your actual soccer coach that's not a family member, showing you these things and teaching you these things. But then you have to practice it over and over and over and over again. And it's only going to be effective if you do it so many times, then when the opportunity arises in the game, you don't think about it. You just do it. It's instinct. Just like when you're walking, Benny, you're not thinking about, okay, right leg forward, heel, toe, plant, left leg forward, heel. No, we've all done it. So you just do it naturally. You don't even think about walking. You don't think about breathing. You don't think about all these sorts of things. That's how much you have to practice it to actually execute what you just said. The move before the first touch to actually get out of pressure. And by the way, that's a secondary or tertiary skill. Because if you don't already have a good first touch without doing the move, how are you going to do the move and have a good first touch? No, you have to have a good first touch first, and then you layer on the body feints before you actually receive the ball. Imagine trying to do the body feint first and then actually receiving the ball and having a good first touch. It's that much harder.
Yeah, no, it takes thousands and thousands of hours of training it and then going to execute it. What about, Gary, in the team training environment? You see a lot of teams in the U.S. where maybe 70% of the session, Gary, is all technical work. So passing patterns, dribble through and play the next person, working on, passing, receiving. Is there a place for that in the team training environment, or are you going to get more benefits in terms of the first touch you're still talking about? Are you going to get more benefit from executing rondos every day with your teams in the environment?
Yeah. So these sorts of things are all integrated in the rondos. That's why they're so powerful. Massive numbers of repetition, pressure is included. Body feints are naturally a tool, a skill that you're going to have to develop in a rondo. Otherwise, the defender and everybody closes down on you. And if you don't have that tool, you are going to be the weak link and you are going to lose the ball and you are going to get exposed. So the rondos train this like crazy. And the rondos are not robotic. It's improvisation. Okay. Yes, there are restrictions in rondos, but within the restrictions, it's all improvised. The coach is not saying, hey, you pass to him, then you pass to him, then you pass to him, and then the pattern repeats itself. No, in a rondo, it's just nonstop action improv all over the field. And part of that improvisation is how you're going to do the skill that you just described, Benny, versus the other thing you mentioned, which is not Rondo's, and it's doing technical work, what people here in America think is technical work. Rondo's are technical work, but people here in America have been brainwashed and think otherwise, which is putting cones, putting flags, and then the coach kind of lays out, this is the pattern that we are going to execute. You pass it to him. You have to have a good first touch and go through these cones. And then you pass it to him. You pass it to the other guy. And over and over and over and over again. That's shit. That's trash, Benny. Sorry. I shouldn't talk shit on... whatever.
You're good.
It's frustrating. It's frustrating. It's so frustrating, man.
I know we're not talking about Rondo's today, but I've seen this so many times, Gary, where... like before a game or you see other teams trying to do a rondo, but the coach has them each glued to the cone, basically. So you're not allowed to move off the cone. One guy in the middle. And I'm just thinking, like, what are you doing, bro? Like, allow the kids and the players to move off the ball and show at an angle, but they're just stuck at the ground. And they think they're doing a rondo, but it's like, it's just so unrealistic, dude. When in the game are you ever standing still? Waiting to receive a pass like that. Doesn't make sense to me.
Well, that's why there's so much backlash, effective backlash against rondos, because what people think are rondos are not actually the rondos in the true sense of the word. So what they see is what you just described. And then they're like, oh yeah, this is not game realistic. Oh yeah, this is no way to train players. Oh yeah, this is just making robots. Yeah, no shit, because you actually aren't doing a rondo. You actually aren't doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah. Let me ask you this.
Hey, Gary, speaking about jab, 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 right hook like Gary V, folks, go to 343coaching.com. That's what sponsors all our work here. We have our whole coaching methodology right there for you. Sign up. Don't be a fool, but it comes out naturally. You're not a fool. I'm just saying, what a tremendous missed opportunity if you haven't signed up. Go to 343coaching.com right now. Sign up for the premium program. Get on board. When you start going through the lessons and the methodology as a whole, don't think to yourself, oh, this is too easy. This is too simple. I just saw these drills about Borussia Dortmund, or I saw these drills from this other fool or from this guy or from that guy. And they're using all these big words. And this is the modern way of doing stuff in Germany. You know, you got the Gegenpress shit and like all this. You know what I'm talking about, Benny. You know what I'm talking about. Humble yourself. Come back down to earth, okay? You're not Pep, you're not Mourinho, you're not any of these guys, okay? Don't try to complicate your life. Get back to basics. The fundamentals never change, Benny. In the history of football, the fundamentals are the fundamentals. Do you know how to receive? Do you know how to dish it out under all these scenarios? And then do you know how to play within the context of a team? And that possession is fundamental to the game. It's fundamental. It never changes. So people should stop trying to look for the next big thing. What's the new trend? What's new? This is a huge frustration here in American soccer because people don't know any better. I don't know if you've been paying attention, probably not, because you know you were a player and then you were zoned into what you were doing. But I've been in this space for 15, 20 years. And after every World Cup or every Euro, okay, it's all these marketers, all these coaching educators out there. It's always the same thing. Learn how to play like Spain. Learn how to play like Germany. Learn how to play like France. Learn how to play like Portugal. Whoever happened to have won the Euros that year, all their marketing materials is like, learn how to play like the Croatians. Learn how to do a turn like Luka Modric, you know? The fuck? Wait. What's going on here? Ben, no, it's so annoying. It's so goddamn annoying.
That's easy for them to market that. The same thing with Champions League. Anytime a club wins a Champions League, you'll see the next week or 2 weeks, learn this Real Madrid passing pattern activation that they do before the game, or learn this rondo that Real Madrid's doing. Look, they just won the Champions League, so must be credible. And if it's Real Madrid, okay, I understand, but you know. Gary, give us some, when you were growing up or even today, we mentioned a lot about the biomechanics and how it just looks natural and fluid for some players. Who do you think had the best first touch that you've ever seen and was able to do damage with it?
Are you talking about players that I personally like coached and been around?
What are you talking about? No, I'm saying like on the world stage, professional players.
Oh, world football.
Yeah. I want people to be able to leave here and go look at actual examples of what it is that you're describing.
Man, it's really hard to come up with a, it's really hard to beat prime Barcelona. It's just really hard, Benny. It sounds like a cop-out, but it's just true. And when you hear now testimony, 10 years, 15 years later, testimony from now retired players reflecting on when they had to play Barcelona. Like you see Rio Ferdinand. Rio Ferdinand has his own show, former Manchester United legend, English national team forever. When he's reflecting, he's always saying, man, you know, when we had to play Barcelona, especially in that Champions League final, like we had no idea, like the technique on these players, it's impossible. Their first touch is so outrageously impeccable, like you can't compete. They will not lose the ball. They do whatever the hell they want with it. They are masters of the ball and of the first touch, obviously. So it's hard for me to say other names other than Sergio Busquets, Xavi Hernandez, Andres Iniesta. And I mentioned Jordi Alba before because Jordi Alba has an incredible first touch. So many passes that he's received, 40-yard diagonal balls, say from Messi or from whatever, when he's darting up the left flank and out of the air, in stride, full sprint, just left leg up, tuck, and then falls, and the stride continues, and the ball is perfectly placed right there for him to continue at full speed. You know how hard that shit? Anthony Robinson will never fucking do that. It ain't happening, dude. It ain't happening. So I always referred to those Barca players, and it's going to sound crazy what I'm going to say next. The names I just mentioned, I get the sensation like their first touch is better than Messi's first touch. You know what I mean? But the reason I say that too is because Messi has a different profile and a different function. And his main function is to absolutely damage the opponent by dribbling and attacking the space, or even if there is no space, blowing by people. So he's not there trying to kind of like receive and pass, right? Or control and then pass. It's a different thing. Maybe this is just part of his genius, obviously. It just seems more chaotic. His first touch seems more chaotic. Like it comes when he's in traffic, especially. There's a moment of chaos, and you as the observer think to yourself, oh, you fucked up, but he didn't fuck up. Like it looked like his first touch was a complete fuck up, but it wasn't a fuck up.
Yeah, and I know exactly what you're saying. But if you think about it, Gary, it's all the guys you mentioned, right? Busquets, Iniesta, Xavi, center mids, right? And so what is their main action that they're getting on the field every single time? Receiving the ball with massive amounts of pressure around them every single time. And so you are forced to have a good touch, bro, if you are a center mid playing at the highest level. Because if you don't, you're going to get exposed so easily. Versus a winger, maybe a winger receives a ball, the outside back is 5 yards away from them, and they have a little bit more room for error. But in the middle, bro, there's literally no room to make a mistake. For me, my favorite guy and who I think had the best first touch of all time, Zidane, bro. That forward was insane with this first touch, dude. I think there's a video on YouTube titled like Zidane's First Touch or something, and it's just clip after clip after clip of him just destroying opponents with his first touch. Ball's getting pinged at 60 miles an hour or 50 miles an hour, and he just drops it on a dime, bro.
But you see how it's also different than the other players we just mentioned.
Right.
It's not the same. Yeah. It's a different thing.
For sure. And they're getting different types of balls too. You know, as a center mid, you're not getting a 40-yard diagonal ball. But yeah, dude. Yeah. How was your first touch, Gary?
Genius.
Chaotic.
I'm like that dad that I just made fun of in the beginning of the episode, where it's like, oh, look at my fucking first touch control. Yeah, but okay, what kind of space did I have? All that stuff, dude. Of course.
Yeah, I mentioned it, but I don't think we addressed it. Homework that Brian would assign to his players. If a player's coming up to Brian and say, or even to you, hey Brian, hey Gary, I know my first touch needs a lot of work. What do I do to fix it? How can I make it better? What was the assignment that you guys would give them?
A lot of functional work, honestly, Benny. The wall was an obvious thing that would be said to everybody, okay? Because that gives you repetitions and it develops a foot sensitivity for you so that your brain starts just getting used to it over and over again. But mostly functional stuff. So if it's an outside back, what you mentioned before, hey, learn to maybe dribble at speed and then serve great crosses. So go to the park. Hopefully you have brothers. Hopefully you have your dad. If you don't, it's a little bit more difficult, but work on those curling balls, you know, and pick a target, right? Have it actually land where you want it to land. Strikers, obviously functional work. Go and do 100 million shots on goal. Any type of shot is fine. Just do it over and over and over again. So it's those sorts of functional things, Ben, more than anything else. It's not like we would say specifically, go to the wall and do this exact exercise. I don't think we were saying any of that, even though that's what's in the masterclass, right? In the masterclass, we specifically show you, hey, if you're going to the wall, these are specifically the exercises that you can do that develop these specific things that happen in real life games. So you have to develop that sort of muscle memory for the real life game sort of actions.
Yeah. I know we've done a whole episode, Gary, on the wall and benefits, but I think it's important to just bring it up right here, especially because we're talking about first touch. In your opinion, is the wall the best place to improve your first touch? Or is it in a rondo? Is it receiving passes from a teammate?
You need it all. But if you're alone, obviously the wall is the best. Can you develop a great first touch without the wall? Probably not, which is a weird thing to say, because if you don't have the wall, then that means it's very complicated for you to get a huge number of repetitions. Like, how are you going to get repetitions if you never go to a wall? That means you always have to have somebody with you to work on your game. And if you have somebody with you, you don't really have control over the types of balls that you're going to receive and a high frequency either. So the wall is huge, but you also need to have this exposure to good teammates and in a, like a rondo type of environment with a pressure sort of situation with a coach that's actually applying pressure on you as well to perform. Just like a personal trainer at the gym, right? If you go to the gym by yourself, yeah, you can lift some weights, do this and that, but it's a lot higher likelihood that you're going to not stick to a good routine and be consistent with your routine and push yourself to proper limits if you're by yourself. If you have a personal trainer in the gym, they, with expertise, they know how to push you and it forces you to get better. So the same thing with a coach in a coaching environment within a rondo, you have somebody applying pressure to you for you to improve. So you need everything, dude, fucking everything. And pickup games are huge too, because in the pickup environment, Benny, if you're repeatedly effing up, fucking up your first touch and you're turning the ball over, guess what? You aren't going to be picked anymore to play on teams. So until you get better, you aren't getting picked, or you're just going to be clowned on over and over again. And that's also going to mentally kind of incentivize you to improve and get better and focus and make sure you try not to lose the ball in the pickup game, because you don't want homie over here who's 14 and you're 11 years old. You don't want the 14-year-old bully in the park being like, what the fuck, Benny? Like, you fucking suck my balls. Is that not true, though? I think all the ingredients matter, man.
It's true. Sadly, that I don't think that culture exists anymore due to going to a park and you being the little kid playing against men, because adults don't allow that to happen, bro. It's like, no, like, I'm not going to let my son play against kids that are 5 years older than him. That's so unfair. His confidence is going to get destroyed. I don't think that exists nowadays, dude. Sad.
Yeah, I don't know. I do know that it did exist up to maybe 10 years ago. Remember, I'm just saying 10 years, you know, ago, because you're familiar with it. When we would go to the La Habra indoor rink there, we had kids of all ages and sizes show up, and we wouldn't really tell them, oh, no, you can't play little man or something. No. I mean, you were little man at some point too, right? And you just get thrown in there. So I've seen it, but up until 10 years ago, you're probably right. It probably doesn't exist anymore. But that's also true. Again, I'm speaking from my experience and from my network of close friends and colleagues around the world. It's not really happening as much everywhere across the world.
The decline of football is coming, good. Or maybe it's already here.
Well, I mean, you heard it from a lot of pros, former pros who are now coaches or sporting directors or whatever. They're constantly saying that the game is basically dead and there are no more players with flair and creativity, and that it's all very chess-like and it's all very robotic in that regard, where players are positionally restricted, you know, and perform very specific functions on the field. And the number 10 is dead, right? Fabregas talks about this all the time. The creative number 10s don't exist anymore. Or if they do exist, coaches and clubs don't want them. You know, they would rather have a Weston McKennie type, put them in the middle of the field, the typical box-to-box sort of player, instead of the creative Roman Riquelmes. And they're gone. So, yeah, it's sad. I don't know if the pendulum's going to swing back the other way. It seems to a certain extent that there is a swinging of the pendulum. Remember, Argentina won the last World Cup, and now play like Argentina. That's the way to do it, you know? And what is Argentina been all about under Scaloni? You've heard Scaloni say many times in public talks about letting the players play. And Aymar, you know, his assistant coach, Pablito Aymar, the legend, also saying, yeah, we, you know, at the youth levels in particular, we should just let the kids play. The academies have been too professionalized at this point, you know, doing that, so much tactics, you know, you should just let them express themselves. And you have people here in the United States retweeting that shit and saying, yeah, yeah, that's how it should be. That's what I've been telling everybody for so long. Let the kids play. The game is the best teacher. All that fucking nonsense. Not understanding the context that you're in the United States and they're in Argentina. So you're getting something completely out of context and trying to apply it over here. That's a whole other episode, Benny. But is the pendulum swinging that way a little bit? It seems like, because in Europe, what are they doing and have done historically? They go to South America to get their talent. Why? Because in South America, it's more this pickup free-for-all sort of player, creative player. And in Europe, it's been so professionalized, tactically professionalized, that they don't have the Dinos, the Neymars, the Mastantuonos, the Messis, the Los Chelsos. I don't have the solution, Benny. This is why soccer is beautiful. It's culture versus culture, like literally sometimes, philosophy versus philosophy, idea versus idea. And not the same idea doesn't always win. Argentina doesn't always win. Brazil doesn't always win. Sometimes you get the German robots, right, winning the World Cup. Oh, Gary, what are you talking about, the robots? No, yeah, they're robots. They're fucking machines. Do they have good first touches? Does Toni Kroos have a great first touch? Of course. I'm not saying he doesn't have great first touch, but is Toni Kroos the same type of player as a Brazilian flair creative player? No, it's a completely different animal. Compared to freaking Neymar, Toni Kroos is a robot. He's a Terminator T-100, okay? Came from the future, and he has metal for bones.
Now, while you were speaking, Gary, something came to my mind. I know I asked you early in the episode, you know, why does it seem like the U.S. players are so far behind and the rest of the world, the players seem so fluid? But I'm wondering if the fact that American culture, U.S. national team, even MLS, they haven't valued the player profile of supremely technical on the ball. Their main focus has been big, fast, and strong. And so those are the types of players that get elevated. I'm wondering if that's a major ingredient as to why we don't have as good as first touch as they do around the world. You know, that type of player doesn't really get elevated. And so as a player here, what are you forced to do? You're forced to become fast. You're forced to become strong. And hopefully you're big, dude. Otherwise, you're going nowhere.
Yeah. No, be an energizer bunny. It's not a coincidence that somebody like Ricky Pooch, right, got elevated here at the LA Galaxy and did well in the league. If you look at Ricky Pooch, look, it's hard to judge too in a certain respect because since he was at Barcelona during a very good Barcelona era, how can you break into that midfield? It's like goddamn fucking impossible. Okay, it's damn near impossible to break in. So it's hard to judge him or sneer at him, but Ricky Pooch doesn't have the first touch of that level. He just doesn't. But he is an energizer bunny. He's an energizer bunny. Runs all over the field. He kind of reminds me like a Brendan Aaronson. So it's not surprising that he comes over here and yeah, they play him and he became a very good player here in MLS. Versus an Efrain Alvarez, who has a way better first touch and a lot more creativity and a lot different vision, a lot different player profiles, type of player profile that we like and we want to see more of here in the United States. Nah, I mean, he played at the Galaxy. That's a whole other story too. But was he elevated? Was he made into a star at the LA Galaxy? Was he given the number 10 jersey at the LA Galaxy and said, this is your team, let's build around you, take it over? No, not at all. He is kind of like a whatever, you know, kind of on the side there, lingering around, just existing. And now in Guadalajara, Chivas Guadalajara, okay, you're the number 10, Efra. This is your team. You're the man. You're in charge. And lo and behold, right, Argentinian coach at Chivas, he knows what quality is. Okay. And he said the other day that I think a reporter asked him a pretty detailed question about, hey, do we need to change the midfield, like the getting players that have more of this or that or the other thing? And you should have seen Milito's face. He's like, the fuck, we have Efrain Alvarez. Like, well, what are you talking about?
Yeah. So not to mention Gary fucking Zlatan at the Galaxy saying, this is the best kid I've ever seen. And yeah, sure enough, the Galaxy didn't want to build around him because he wasn't valued. You don't value that type of player.
He was 16 years old, Benny. Hopefully you can find that clip if you don't mind digging it up. I'm sure it's out there. Yeah, where Zlatan said, hey, this is one of the best 16-year-olds I've ever seen at this level. Yeah, he's still young. Yeah, he's still got a lot to learn, you know.
First off, can you speak about the impact that Efrain had when he came into the game?
He did a good game. He came in good. He's full of confidence. I mean, when you have the fans cheering to you like they do in his case, you get extra motivated. But he's only 16 years old. Don't forget his age. And I said yesterday, I think, when I was talking to the media, he's the best talent in MLS by far. And the club, the team, the coach has to take care of him in the right way.
He's growing every day. He's only 16, 17. He's still young. But for me, he's ready. For me, he knows more football. You have players that play football, and you have players that think football. He's the player that thinks football, and they're the better players. Because the guys that plays football, they are trained to play football. The guys that thinks football, they are made to play football. That's a big difference. And that's why I say in MLS, he's by far the biggest talent from everybody because he thinks football. He has that football in him, and it's natural. it didn't come by him by training or something. Then obviously you have the training, the physique and all those things that you put together, but you cannot get that, have that football in you. He has it. He goes on the field and you see when he plays, he's all natural, and the way he thinks, the way he moves the ball, the way he touches the ball, by far the best player in MLS. He just needs his game time and he will show it also.
But you know Zlatan is not going to say that for just anybody. Zlatan, it's quite the opposite. Zlatan would be like, we have fucking shit players here.
Sure. All right, Gary, anything else on first touch? I feel like there's maybe a lot that we missed, maybe in the comments, if there's other stuff that you want to hear about first touch. But any closing thoughts on first touch, Gary, why it matters, why it's so important? How do you tell if your kid actually has a good first touch? There's so many things.
Yeah, that's so hard, Ben. You don't get exposed until you continue going up the levels. And that's just the reality. So I think a big pitfall that both players, and if we're talking to youth here, that players and parents both fall into the trap of thinking that you're good because at the level you're currently playing at, you don't get exposed. And so your first touch is clean. It's nice. You don't lose it. And you're just blissfully unaware of the higher levels and how bad you would look if you were placed into a higher level. I think that's the biggest pitfall that folks have. And so you stop working as hard because you think you've already got it, but you don't got it. Keep working, kids.
So true, Gary. I mean, even all the way up until U16, U17, at the club level, acres of space, Gary, massive amount of time and space on the ball. So you can think that, I have a great first touch. Even if you're collecting the ball and it drops perfectly for you. Okay, now try doing that when somebody's running at you 50 miles an hour and closing down the space. You literally have no time. Can you still perform under that pressure? That's a different aspect of it too, man. It's not just being able to receive a ball from your teammate. Hey, I'm up training. My teammate pings me a ball. I have a perfect first touch. Okay. Now try and do it when three guys are pressing you and you have nowhere else to go. Can you still perform?
Or even the psychological pressure, if we start talking about the professional level, not even the physical pressure of defenders around you, the psychological pressure of, all right, kid, or all right, bench warmer, you're in today, you know, the other guy's hurt. And you know that you have to perform. And if you don't have a top level first touch, then that means it's not natural for you. Like me walking. Okay. It's not natural. You have, if you still have to focus, oh, here it comes. I gotta make sure I have a good first touch. Let me move my body like this so I have a good first touch. If you are thinking of things like that, you're going to fuck up. You're not ready. It has to be natural, Benny. It has to be something that you don't feel any pressure. It's just like, you just do it.
You just described me in high school, bro.
No. But I think that is a very good indicator for players, because parents don't know if the kid is actually thinking about these things when it's happening, right? But that's a good indicator for players. If you as a player are thinking about, oh, here it comes, I have to have a first touch. If you're thinking about it, you don't have a good first touch. You just don't have it. The other thing that's important is the whole notion of technical debt. Maybe I'll just read the article that I wrote on technical debt and inject it in here. But technical debt, in short, because I know people are familiar with Kobe Bryant. Kobe Bryant has famously said how he's also gotten so good is the amount of hours that he's put into the work. So he gives the example, okay, I wake up at 3 a.m, I go have a workout from 3 to 4 or 3 to 5 or something, come home, you know, have breakfast, get the kids ready for school or whatever. And then now it's 7 a.m, I go and I have my second workout from 7 to 9, you know, and then whatever, come back home, shower, relax a little bit, you know, catch my breath, maybe do a little ice pack or something. And then I'm back out to the stadium at 11, 11 to 2 or 11 to 1, I'm with the team. And now that he's with the team, those players on the Lakers on his team, that's their first session. Kobe already has gone 3 or 4 hours in. And then after that session, goes home, chilled, whatever, lunch, family. And then he does a fourth session. And he's like, hey, after 5, 6, 7, 8 years of me doing that, you know, from the age of 17 or 18, bro, I don't care if all of a sudden you in the NBA at age 22 or 25 or whatever, you're like, I'm going to get serious now. You can't catch up. It's fucking over. You can never make up those hours that you've already lost that I put in. So this is what I coined technical debt. Technical, not meaning technique, although it's related, but technical debt is a software development term whereby if you're writing code and you make this huge application, this program, this software project, and you haven't been meticulous about doing things right and the thing gets bigger and bigger and bigger and something breaks, all of a sudden you have a shit code base and you've accrued all this debt and now you have to pay the debt. How are you going to pay the debt? It's a disaster. Benny. So same thing with players. If you don't put in the time, or if you've learned the wrong things in the wrong way up until your age 14 or 15, and somebody's been doing it the right way for a lot longer, and they're 14 or 15, you are never catching that 14 or 15 year old ever in your life. If somebody like Lamine Yamal, who got his whole soccer education at La Masia and whatever else he did outside of La Masia, by the time he's 14 or 15, and then compare somebody here in the United States or in Brazil or in Paraguay, it doesn't have to be the United States, and they have not had the La Masia environment, that sort of cultural environment, those sorts of hours, and now you're 13, 14, 15 years old, you are never catching Lamine Yamal. I don't care how much harder you work from this point forever forward, because you're working harder than ever before, but he's also continues to work and continues getting better and better. You're not catching the guy. It's over. It is over. I hate to end on that note, but when you asked me before, when is it too late? And I kind of said 14, 15. If you don't kind of have it by 14, 15, you can kiss Lamine Yamal status goodbye or world-class goodbye. And people got mad at me years ago and still to this day when I say, oh, Josh Sargent doesn't have it. And I said that. I'm going to have to look this up on Twitter. I probably said this thing 8 years ago or something. What are you talking about, Gary? He's only 18. Or what are you talking about, Gary? This player is only 22. He's just starting. He's so young. He's not fucking young. It's fucking game over already. You can get better. You can get better. But you ain't going to get that much better.
It's a great way to end it, Gary. Look at this.
All right.
Legends never die, bro. Kobe.
Oof. Love that. It kind of looked, because you're all blurry on my screen right now because of the bad reception. I thought you were showing me Chiellini for some reason. Because maybe I just saw a bald profile. I'm like, oh, that looks like Chiellini.
That would be a sick hoodie, dude. That would be a sick hoodie. One of my favorite Italian players of all time. Good stuff, brother. Hopefully, towards the end of the episode, you know, parents don't get discouraged. I mean, dude, if the kid truly wants it, I think they can make it, bro. But you're going to have to put in massive amount of time, energy, effort, a true love of the game. That's what it takes, man. And there's always somebody working harder than you.
The good news, Ben, is that since you're in the United States, if we're talking to those parents, players are so bad here. Things are so bad here. And the players make it so bad here that you can still make it.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like if your son is 12 or 13 or 14 or something like that, if you start now and you can turn the ship around and you can make it. Were as good as your kid is now, but you were in Argentina, you're probably fucked. It's over. Or in Spain, it's over.
MLS one day, dude, you can make it. Kids out there. You should title the video, how to make it, how to become a player in MLS, bro.
It's not. Easy. It's never too late. It's never too late.
Dude, I want people to look up this guy, World Cup Dad. I think I brought him up on the podcast before, but I don't know, he's like in his late 20s or maybe even in his 30s. And like 2 years ago, he's like, you know what? Like, I'm going to dedicate every day of my life to becoming a professional soccer player. Never kicked the ball before in his life. Okay. And now it's 2-3 years later. And has he made like some improvements? Yes. But you still, when you watch him, you're like, oh my God, bro, what is this guy doing? Like, I guess he signed some type of like pro, like arena soccer contract or whatever. But you, when you watch him kick a ball still, it's just like absolutely shocking, bro. It's hilarious. Credit to the guy. Respect to him. He's like literally every single day for like 8 hours, this guy's training, Gary, but you just started too late, my guy.
You ever seen that video of Dana White many years ago where he went on a very good rant with respect to how soft everybody has become in the country? And the context was, he's like, everybody is so soft and everybody doesn't want to work and everybody's lazy and everybody's entitled. And you should look at that as an advantage. You should look at that as a massive opportunity that has never existed before in this country. Because if you even work a little bit, right, and take things at least a little serious, you can become somebody in this country. You could become a beast, right? If you really work hard and sacrifice and go hardcore, man, you can crush everybody.
There has never been more opportunity in this world than there is right fucking now.
If you're a fucking savage and you get out there and you grind hard and you want it bad enough, you can run all these guys over, man.
If you are even fucking remotely a savage, you'll run these people over. Mm-hmm. This next generation.
It's just such a fucking group of pussies.
If you are even remotely a savage, you will run over every one of these kids in this next generation.
For the small group of savages out there, run these fucking kids right over, man. Run them all over.
I had a quote installed on my wall. It says, "May God have mercy upon my enemies, because I won't." So let's fucking go.
So it's true in soccer as well in the United States. Everybody is so soft, so entitled, not putting in hardcore hours at all, not doing the right things, that if you as a kid or as a family, as a parent, if you take it seriously, it doesn't take that much to really surpass your peers. You really can, Benny, especially if the kid is young, 10, 11, 12, I don't care if you're from the suburban American mainstream demographic that I always kind of say, yeah, you guys suck, right? You guys don't know how to play soccer. You don't have the culture. You don't have the heritage. You don't know what to do, what not to do. Even if you're that person, that kid, you can make it, because everybody's sucking ass around here. Just put in double or triple, quadruple the amount of work and hours that you're currently putting in. And don't fall for the scammers out there. There's a lot of scammers.
There you go. No more, parents, please, no more. Don't spend $125 on an hour of personal training, please.
Is that what they're charging?
So, dude, some trainers are charging that much, dude, if not more. And they use their status of, oh, I played Division I, or I played in MLS for a year or 2 years, or I played USL. Okay. And you're still going to charge a parent $125? I want people in the comments, the most expensive personal training you've seen. I want to see what people say, because I know it's out there, dude. I know there's 100 plus an hour, and parents are going every week, dude. Every week. Wow.
There is a market for it. There is a market for it. And I know that this is a different context than what you just described, but the reality is, because I've been approached many times, or I get emails or messages, oh, Gary, I live in, you know, Southern California, Orange County, or LA, you know, what do you think? I got a son. Can you do some personal training? And for me, it's different because I value my time outside of soccer. I'm doing all kinds of stuff. I'm bandwidth limited. I don't want to be a personal trainer. Okay. I don't care about that at all. But yeah, if you wanted to buy my time, it's $1,000 an hour, Benny. It's just saying, you know, it ain't happening. But that's not what these personal trainers are doing. It's just, this is the market. There are parents out there that are well-to-do and they want their kid to improve and get more touches on the ball. And okay, here you go, $100 an hour. I don't blame them. I'm sure they're learning something.
Yeah, for sure. And they're getting content to post on their Instagram and their TikTok account. So, you know, good for them. But you know what, Gary, mark my words, somebody's going to come to you and say, hey, Gary, I heard you're charging $1,000 for a personal training. I probably
wouldn't do it. Honestly, I probably would not do it
for $1,000. You wouldn't do it. One session.
I probably wouldn't do it, Benny, honestly, because it's not worth $1,000. My time is worth $1,000, but what they're going to get is not worth $1,000. That's the point. You know, that's why I would charge $1,000, because my time is worth that much. But what they would receive is not $1,000 worth of value.
Yeah. Well, you're a very honest man, Gary. It's a lot of people will not say that. They'll say, oh yeah, you in fact are getting $125 worth of value from this 1 hour session. So there you go.
That's rough. That I don't know how to justify. I can justify people's time being worth $100, if that's how they value it, that's what it's worth. But what the person is receiving is not worth $100. Tell you that much for goddamn sure. Go fucking kick a ball against the wall. The wall is worth more than $100, worth more than the personal trainer.
Wall is priceless, bro.
Sorry, Benny. Enough shitting on people. I'll cut all this out. Okay, Benny, anything else?
Nah, dude, I think that's good.
Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.